This is the MedicCast, November 10th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. This is episode 143. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode. If you are a brand new listener to the show, welcome to the MedicCast. I'd like to urge you to head over and check out the MedicCast website. You'll find the MedicCast blog, show notes, and article pages over at MedicCast.com/blog. And of course, if you go to MedicCast.com, that's the main page for the network. You'll find links to this show, to the nursing show, and all the other podcasts that we put out here at MedicCast Productions. But this is the MedicCast, a program for EMTs and paramedics by EMTs and paramedics. And that makes this a community effort. In fact, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all the longtime listeners, people who contribute over at the MedicCast forums, here contributing by email, sending in their voicemail comments, really keeping in touch with this community. And this is one of the things that makes this the best EMS podcast, the EMS program on the web. And we're going to keep it that way. We are going to be talking a little bit about cough and cold medicines later in the show. That's been in the news lately, and we might run into some of these issues as the cold and flu season is in full swing here, and we run into parents who have dosed their children with these medications. So we're going to touch base with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Center a little later on in this episode to find out exactly what's going on with this controversy surrounding pediatric cough and cold medications. Don't forget, if you have any comments on this episode, questions, or even corrections, send them in to podmedic@mac.com. That's podmedic@mac.com. Or you can comment over at the MedicCast forums. You'll find the MedicCast forums at forums.mediccast.com. And this is a community within the community. These are the diehards there. And you can get answers to questions. You can answer other people's questions there in the forums. You can leave photographs, videos. It's a great way to just participate here in the MedicCast over at forums.mediccast.com. I'm going to answer some listener email. First off, I got an email in from our good friend Eric Augustus over at EMS Haiku. And this EMS Haiku blog you can find over at emshaiku.blog-city.com. And Eric writes great EMS poetry. And so I kind of threw down the gauntlet recently on a post over at the MedicCast blog where I was talking about EMS humor, some of the phrases that we use commonly to kind of make fun of things we run into on a regular basis, maybe terms we use to refer to a certain type of patient, whatever they may be. These are some of the little comical things that we use to refer to people or refer to situations and helps us get through our day a little bit easier. So I was listing some of them following last month's MedicCast Live episode, where some of these terms came up in the discussion. We have a live discussion there once a month, and that's another one coming up later this week. I'll talk about that later in the show. But I kind of made a list of them, and then I thought, well, what about my good friend Eric? Can he write EMS haiku using some of these terms? And by golly, he did it. He came up with some pretty good ones. So, Eric, thank you for rising to the occasion. I'm sure you'll come up with some others. But I thought this would be a great opportunity to open this discussion up a little bit. What are some of the funny phrases, terms, and things you use to describe situations or patients that you run into? We want to keep it reasonably clean, but you can head over to the MedicCast forums, and I've opened up a new thread there and actually created a new category called EMS Humor. Find that thread over there in the MedicCast forums and go ahead and leave your own reply. What are some of the phrases and terms you use? See if you can come up with some new ones. And maybe when Eric heads over there and checks it out, he can leave some new EMS haiku for you. That's the best I can do at rhyming, folks. Sorry. I also got an email from listener Brian, and he was checking in about the brand new MedicCast Shock DVD. This is our Shock Simplified DVD, and he was asking if that DVD is available in some form over at the MedicCast Extra. And actually, Brian, the videos are available in separate segments. In other words, the different chapters on the different types of shock, those video segments are available for viewing and download over at MedicCastExtra.com as part of the subscription services there. The DVD is available through the MedicCast store, so if you need it actually on a physical disc, you can pick it up there. And there are actually some extras available on the disc that you won't find at the MedicCast Extra, things like the instructor resources and stuff like that. But if you are a subscriber to the MedicCast Extra, you can pick up the information, most of the information available on the DVD from the site. But I wanted to make sure that you got that information, and other people might have had a similar question. So a lot of the information and things you'll find at the MedicCast store in DVD form or CD form are similar, but not necessarily identical to some similar things you'll find at the MedicCast Extra site. And that's just because I can do different things on a disc than I can do on a site and vice versa. So take advantage of whichever opportunity works best for you, I guess would be the answer for you, Brian. I also had a bunch of listeners ask questions about the MedicCast newsletter this week, so I just wanted to remind you that if you go to MedicCast.com/blog, right there in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see the sign-up sheet that you can fill in the blanks and submit your name to become a member of the MedicCast newsletter. And we've had quite a few members join the newsletter this past month, and including Rick, Joel, Chad, Adam, and quite a few others. So if you're interested in getting information from the MedicCast, things like our show notes links all emailed to you directly. Also, sometimes we get some special deals that come through just for MedicCast listeners. Not too often, but a couple of times a month, I post up those particular items as well. And of course, we also, anytime there's a special live item here at the MedicCast, such as the MedicCast Live, you'll get a reminder that that is going to be live that evening. So all of those things come to you just for free for joining the MedicCast newsletter. And it's a great resource for you if you're a solid member of this community. You'll probably want to be on the newsletter as well. So there, that answers the questions that I got in about the MedicCast newsletter. Let's jump on into this week's news, and the first item in the news has to do with public AED access. Anybody who's listening to the MedicCast for any length of time knows that I'm a big proponent of two things: public CPR education and public access to AEDs. And I found another story this week talking about why public access to AEDs is so darned important. This comes out of Illinois, and it was an Illinois intermediate school basketball game that a person, actually the referee at the game, fell unconscious at halftime during a sixth grade girls' basketball game. As he collapsed, four parents raced to his rescue. They began to assess him, started CPR, and brought the automatic external defibrillator available in the school to the patient's side and revived him with a shock. This is the reason why AEDs are so extremely valuable in locations wherever we have large numbers of people gathering. Because guess what? How long was it going to take them to get an ambulance to this location? We all know that this is the reason a lot of cardiac arrest patients, especially younger, healthier cardiac arrest patients, die, because they don't have immediate access to defibrillation. Remember your chain of survival from your CPR classes: early access to 911 emergency services. 911 was activated. Early CPR, early defibrillation, and early advanced care. Okay, ALS is last on the list, folks. We need to get early CPR and defibrillation to these patients so that if they can be defibrillated, they will be defibrillated most successfully as soon after the arrest occurs as possible. So this is why we need to get public access AEDs in more locations, in our places in our communities where people gather: churches, banquet halls, schools, sporting event arenas. Any of these locations are prime candidates for AEDs. Find out from your local or state emergency medical services programs whether there are grant dollars available to help you put AEDs into other locations in your community, to help you provide training to your community members. This is something that is going to make more difference than almost anything else you do in your community. So I urge you to check this article out. Look for similar articles. You know, if you find out an article, something like this in your community, send me a link or send me a copy of the article here at the Medicast. You can reach me at podmedic@mac.com. These are things I firmly, firmly believe in, and I love to hear about public access, CPR, and AED use saving lives. So next up in the news, we're going to move on to a cautionary tale I picked up from the Houston area. And this is about a man who jumped from the back of a moving ambulance on the highway and was struck and killed by oncoming traffic. Now, this occurred when they were taking this patient to the hospital following an overdose. He removed his restraints, attempted to open the side door of the ambulance, and began threatening to jump. The ambulance stopped, and the patient jumped out of the ambulance, ran across the lanes into the other side of the highway where he was struck by oncoming traffic. This is a cautionary tale. Now, I'm not sure there's anything these guys could have done to stop this. If somebody wants to do something stupid and kill themselves, we all know they're more than capable of doing it. But it's something that you need to be aware of whenever you have a patient who is at risk for making bad decisions, whether they've been using an illegal substance, whether they're drunk, whether they are a behavioral patient. You need to have a heightened level of awareness of exactly what this patient may do. Now, clearly this patient was in some form of restraint, probably the buckles and seatbelts that were in place as part of their stretcher. But again, in a situation like this, it's always a good idea to consider, and I'm not saying this is always an option, but to consider having a police officer or having another responder or first responder at the scene come along with you in the back of the ambulance to provide additional resources should you need them. You don't want to be trapped in the back of a unit by yourself with someone who may become violent, and you don't want to be in a situation where you are trying to hold on to someone to keep them from injuring themselves and are unable to do so. Now, I don't know if anyone's going to be sued over this, but we know how people can get, especially when they can find someone else who'll say that these guys made a mistake. I'm not saying that. The person threatened to jump. They pulled the unit over rapidly so that he wasn't jumping out of a moving ambulance. But now we have a patient who's going to leave the ambulance in the middle of a busy road. We are trained to avoid situations where we can become injured. We talk constantly to each other about scene safety. I talk about it all the time. I end every show with scene safety. But it doesn't mean that we can't be vigilant and take steps to protect our patients. Again, I'm not saying anybody did anything wrong here. I don't get between somebody who's going to do me violence and their wishes to get the heck out of Dodge. But again, there sometimes can be situations where you might be able to gain additional resources, having another provider in the back, for instance. This is something to consider for yourself. Whenever I talk about situations like this, remember, my mantra is not to say second-guessing the people that had a situation occur to them, but to talk to you and to myself about, all right, how could I not have this happen to me? Because I don't want to have somebody do this when I'm in the back of an ambulance. This is what we need to think about. Not to say that anyone else did anything wrong, but to learn a lesson from tragedies that occur to help keep those tragedies from happening to us. So I urge you to check this article out. And if you have any comments on this, get back in touch with me. I'd love to hear what you think could have happened or might have happened or what's happened to you in your service. This next article is a great article. I think everybody should clip this one out and send it into their own local newspaper. Maybe somebody will post it. This is from KDKA.com. It's a TV station in Pittsburgh, and it's an item from their website. I urge you to check it out and read it for yourself and talk about it in your communities. Non-emergency calls clog Pittsburgh's EMS system. And this is something we all know about. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir right now, right? You guys deal with non-emergency calls that keep you locked up and away from getting to real emergencies or clog your ER so that when you come back with a real emergency, you have to go on divert to another hospital because you brought too many hangnails in earlier in the day. These situations are causing increasing issues throughout the healthcare system, and this is a great article looking at a particular healthcare system that's dealing with it. So this is what happened. They actually went on a ride along on the call. KDKA investigator Andy Sheehan rode along with some paramedics to see what's going on the streets for real. And he says, and this is a quote from the article, "No sooner do we hit the road with District Chief Scott Everett than we get one of these questionable calls." Well, guess what? We know it happens frequently. I mean, this, you know, real emergencies are rather infrequent, right? I mean, true emergency calls, we don't get that many of them, maybe a couple a day, depending on your service area. But we get a lot of other calls that are questionable emergencies and possibly even not emergencies. Now, we need to be compassionate to these people. You know, I've talked about this before. We have to remember when people call us for a problem, it's because many cases they may think it's an emergency, even though we know it's not from our personal medical experience and knowledge. But there are those patients that abuse the system. There are those systems that have no resources for these people, and they have to use our services to get medical care, even for minor problems. There's a whole host of reasons why this occurs, but certainly this is a great article in a major city news source that is providing us with an opportunity to raise this topic for discussion in our community. So I'm serious. I mean, print this out and send it to your local paper. Ask them to do something similar in your community and examine what's really going on. So a couple weeks ago, I talked a lot about the Maryland medevac crash that occurred. You know, it's touched a lot of us in this region. Looking at our medevac and trauma center services, we're very, very proud of the way our system works, and we stand behind it. In fact, I'll be posting an article later in the week that is a reprint of a letter to EMS providers from the state medical director talking about how our EMS system works and how our trauma and transport system works in the state of Maryland. And I think it's a good look at why we do things the way we do in this state. And I like to see that, but I'm going to look at another side of this. In the course of their investigation, the National Transportation Safety Board, the Maryland Occupational Safety and Health Administration, all of these organizations are looking at why this crash occurred. And so as part of this investigation, they've released the dispatch tapes between CISCOM, our central EMS radio service, and the helicopter service, the Maryland State Police medevac helicopter. And unfortunately, this tape doesn't make us sound very good. And by us, I mean all EMS providers on the ground and in the air. And it's because we have to remember, and, you know, God bless them. First of all, the helicopter crew didn't do anything wrong, but the dispatcher made some statements of commentary during the call that probably he wished he hadn't said because he didn't know they were going to be scrutinized quite so strongly. But we have to remember that we are being recorded, folks. Every single time you hold that button down on your microphone or on your radio, you are being recorded by your dispatch center. And those recordings get locked up and kept for a long time. Don't make statements on the air that don't have to do with the business at hand, because it will come back and bite you in the butt. And that's what happened here. And it's a cautionary tale, something we can learn from a tragic situation. And I wasn't expecting to learn this particular lesson, but, you know, it's a good lesson to learn. What happened was, is that during the dispatch of the call, when medevac was called for a motor vehicle accident to a local ambulance service situation where they were calling for a helicopter to take the patients, the dispatcher told the pilot over the radio that ambulance crews called for the aircraft because, quote, "they never want to drive to the hospital," end quote. Now, that's a comment. That's not a statement of fact, although in the numbers may back up that it might be fact. But it makes us sound petty, and it makes us sound like we're not there to do our jobs. And we need to look at how we use our resources and use them wisely and use them equitably and make sure we're using them appropriately for our patients. But we also need to make sure that we are talking appropriately on the radio and not talking badly about other services that we have to deal with on a regular basis. Because I can guarantee you the agency involved in this discussion, and I'm not going to say their name, but the agency involved, the ground transport units involved, you can guarantee that they're, you know, taking a little heat for the fact that somebody thought this about them. The dispatchers definitely had a talking to, or four, or ten. This is something that we can all learn from. So a tragedy, a bad situation, is a providing a lesson for us to remember that always assume the mic is live, always assume that people can hear what we're saying. So the reason I bring up this cough and cold medicine situation for the tip of the week this week is that there's been some controversy recently here in October, November 2008 about cough and cold medications and their use in pediatric patients. There is no definitive scientific proof that any of these cough and cold medications work for pediatric patients at their dosing levels. The doses have been extrapolated from adult dosing levels, and so there's no real evidence that these medications even work for pediatric patients. Top that off with the fact that parents often don't measure these liquid medicines properly, and you quickly end up with very young pediatric patients, infants and toddlers especially, who become overdosed on these medications. They have medications with acetaminophen in it, which can cause liver damage in high doses. They have other medications that can cause extreme heart conditions, palpitations, and other problems. They have antihistamines that can sedate these patients dangerously. All of these problems occur, and so questions have been raised about cough and cold medications. A year or so ago, medications were removed from the market for infants, and these medicines disappeared. Now they're talking about similar moves for patients up to the age of four, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to bring our good friend Lisa Booz in from Maryland Poison Control and ask her to shed some light on the history of this issue and where she thinks it's heading. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another segment of Tox Tidbits with Lisa Booz from Maryland Poison Center. Lisa, welcome back to the show, and I'm greatly interested in hearing what you have for us this time.
Thanks, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I'm sure that you and most of your listeners have heard about the controversies surrounding children's cough and cold medicines. Are they safe? Are they effective? Should they be taken off the market? Poison centers and really all health professionals are being asked a lot of these questions. And so I would just like to take a little bit of time to shed some light on that matter. Over-the-counter cough and cold medicines for children really have been on the market for many, many years. I mean, we all grew up being given these cough and cold medicines, giving our kids these cough and cold medicines, and they typically contain a combination of antihistamines, decongestants, cough suppressants, and sometimes analgesics like acetaminophen can be in there as well. They come in liquid forms, they come in drops, which are usually pretty concentrated forms of these medicines. They come in easy to swallow tablets, they come in disintegrating tablets, and they also come in nose sprays. And depending on the product, labels have included dosing recommendations for small children, or they've just recommended to consult a physician if the child is under a certain age. Poison centers receive a lot of calls about small children ingesting these cough and cold medicines. In 2006, there were actually more than 60,000 exposures to cough and cold medicines by children under the age of six. That's a lot. Most exposures are toddlers who pick up the brightly colored liquid, or they'll pick up the fruit-flavored medicine, they'll drink some, they'll eat the tablets. Still others are therapeutic errors. A lot of parents give the wrong dose. They don't measure out the dose properly. They might come along and give a double dose, or they may give several products with the same ingredients. Some cases reported to poison centers also are adverse effects to recommended doses, but that's the minority. Most of them are either the therapeutic errors or kids who just pick up the bottle and drink out of it or eat the tablets out of it. Fortunately, very few children develop severe symptoms, and deaths really are very rare. Now, the controversy about the toxicity in small children was brought to the forefront when a group of physicians led by the Baltimore City Health Commissioner petitioned the FDA in 2006 to remove children's cough and cold medicines from the market. They stated that there are safety concerns, and they also brought to light the fact that there's no proof that these medicines are effective in small children. As a matter of fact, in children older than two, The FDA approval of these cough and cold medicines is based on a review of safety and efficacy data by our panel, a review panel. But other reviews that have looked at children under the age of 2 have concluded that they really are not effective, and they're no more effective than placebo in reducing symptoms of the cold. So this prompted the FDA and manufacturers to take a closer look at whether these products are safe and effective. Soon after the petition, some manufacturers voluntarily withdrew over-the-counter cough and cold medicines that were marketed specifically for use in children less than 2 years of age. These were primarily your infant drops with antihistamines and decongestants, and they were commonly sold under the brand names of Dimetapp, Pediacare, Robitussin, Triaminic, and even a Tylenol brand of cough and cold drops for children. Adding fuel to the fire was a report in January of 2007 by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, commonly we call it the CDC, and that report identified 3 infants less than a year old who had died in 2005, and those deaths were associated with cough and cold medicines. Now, all 3 infants had high levels of pseudoephedrine. That's a commonly used decongestant. We commonly know this as being under the brand name Sudafed. And these infants had high levels in their postmortem blood samples, but the levels were 9 to 14 times the levels expected following therapeutic use of the drugs. So that leads us to conclude or to believe that these infants really had received much higher than recommended doses. More recently, there was a study out of the University of Arizona that identified 10 unexpected infant deaths in 2006 in that state that were somewhat associated with cough and cold medication use. Their toxicology testing revealed evidence that all of the infants had been given cough and cold medicines soon before they died, but only one of those deaths could clearly be attributed to the medicine. The families were generally poor. About 50% of those families had limited English proficiency, and only 4 of those infants received medical care for their current illness before they died. So the authors concluded that the results of their study raised concerns about the safety of the medicines and that the warning on the label to consult a physician before giving to small children really is not being followed by parents, and therein lies one of the big problems. Now, in addition to these reports, a panel of physicians and toxicologists, many of whom are associated with poison centers, determined that almost all of the fatalities reported in children were in children less than 2 years of age. In most of the cases identified, there were contributing factors, including, unfortunately, a number of adults who had given large doses of the medicines for non-therapeutic purposes, such as just to sedate their own child, you know, to put them to sleep. And there were also a lot of dosing errors resulting in too much of the drug being given. So based on that, the panel suggested that maybe cough and cold products really should not be used in children under 2, but they probably should remain available for use in children older than 2. They're at much less risk for fatalities and severe symptoms. So after this review of cases, and based on the recommendations of a public advisory committee, the FDA announced in January 2008 that these drugs should not be used in children under the age of 2. So let's fast forward a little bit, a little closer to today, to October 2nd, 2008. It was then that consumer groups really got into the action, and they called on the FDA to pull the children's cough and cold products off the market or to make them available by prescription only. 5 days later, on October 7th of 2008, the makers of children's cough and cold medicines released a statement, and this is across the board, that they were voluntarily changing the labeling to read, "Do not use for children under the age of 4." And an FDA statement the following day stated its support in this decision. So that's where we stand right now. But so what does this mean for the EMS provider, for the nurse, or for other healthcare providers? Well, it's important to understand and reassure parents that severe toxicity and deaths are really very rare unless too much of the drugs are given. And we don't see it really with therapeutic doses of those drugs. Also, that many of the calls to poison centers involve small children who gain access to the product and drink or eat potentially toxic amounts. So it's important to use good poison prevention strategies to keep kids away from these products. So we need to help educate parents also on the proper use of these medicines, how to properly measure out a dose. There are a lot of errors in using medicine cups and syringes, and even teaspoons versus tablespoons. It's also important to recognize that there are alternatives to cough and cold medicines that parents can use and that health professionals can suggest, such as suctioning the nose and using humidifiers instead of using these cough and cold medicines. But one warning, as these medicines are being taken off the market, there may be a chance that there might be more use of more alternative or cultural or herbal type medicines in small children, and they also can be harmful to the infant. So there are a lot of warnings that we need to be aware of, a lot of education that needs to be done to parents and to other caregivers of small children. And we'll see where it goes from here. We'll see what happens in the future.
It sounds to me like education is really the key. I know that one of the things I always really work with patients on is making sure they understand their dosing when we talk about a medication. And for parents, because you're measuring liquids, it's not like an adult form where you're getting a pill and you know to take one pill versus two pills. In a child where you're measuring a liquid medication, really it's incumbent upon the provider, whether it's a nurse or a paramedic or some other medical professional, to actually go over the measurement process with them, to show them how to use the tools properly.
Absolutely, absolutely. We hear of many, many cases where parents just are very confused about how to measure out the dose. And there are products that have very similar names, but they may be different concentrations or different amounts of a particular drug in those products, and so the dosing might be different, and that's very confusing too. So it is important for all of us to sort of get on the bandwagon and make sure that parents know how to use these medicines. And then at the same time, make them aware that they really, in most cases, probably don't need to use the medicines. You know, there are other ways to make their children comfortable without running the risk of making these errors.
Because it really is about treating the symptoms. It's not going to make the virus go away any faster. We're really about making them comfortable, allowing them to rest and get better on their own, really.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, these medicines are not going to do anything to shorten the time span of the symptoms, just to make the children maybe a little more comfortable. And again, there's evidence that in infants that these medicines probably don't even do that.
Great, Lisa. Well, this is a wonderful topic, and you said you would keep us apprised of any changes and updates to this, so we'll be looking forward to those either segments or text updates on the websites in the future.
I would certainly let you know if I hear of anything more.
I want to thank Lisa again for making her time available for us to talk about this particular issue. There are some other links on these medications and some of the information and press releases from the CDC, as well as a great article over at WebMD.com about pediatric cough and cold medications and some of the controversy surrounding them. You should educate yourself about this because you may encounter patients that have received these medications. If you suspect an overdose, bring the medication along with you to the emergency department. Make sure that you hand it to the nurse so that they can provide that information to their ER physicians and contact Poison Center themselves. You can always contact your local Poison Center if you have any questions about this topic or any other topic at 1-800-222-1222, and that's the number here in the U.S. for the local Poison Centers. It's a great resource. Make use of it. They are glad to help out and provide you information on topics like this. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out this week's episode. Make sure you share this with other providers that you know, EMS students or instructors. Let everybody else know about the MedicCast and the resources that we provide here for free every single week. You can also make sure that you head over and check out the links to the news items and the other information in the show notes. Remember, it's your job to make sure you understand how the general information that I present here on the MedicCast fits into your own protocols and guidelines. So I can give you some general information, but you've got to understand and make it work for you. That's your job. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for this show, even corrections on things that I may have misspoken, you want to make sure you get back in touch with me. Let's get the right information out to the MedicCast community. Contact me here by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can call in to the Medicast voicemail line. That's a great way for you to leave your own voice and get to hear it back here on the Medicast. Call in to 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Call in when you have a question or a comment on the show, and maybe you'll hear your voice here on the Medicast. Don't forget to sign up for the Medicast newsletter. You'll find that over at medicast.com/blog in the upper right-hand corner. Also, don't forget, I want to hear back from you at the Medicast forums. Let me know your humorous EMS phrases or names for situations or patients. We love to hear that information, and we'll be providing some more fun information on that as we get that list built up over time. You can find the forums at forums.medicast.com. Time to wrap up the show, and I'll close out, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network. This is from music.podshow.com, and it's Natalie Gelman. We've played some of her songs before here on the show, and I'll have a link to her site in the show notes. Natalie is a great performer, and if you like what you hear, you can check out the link in the show notes to purchase her music directly at iTunes, or go over to her site and let her know you heard it here on the Medicast. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding you to remember scene safety and BSI.
She's got hair of gold, a bright smile, so she's been told. You can find her every night, crying yourself to sleep. Quiet on the edge of my curls, I walk out cheerless into the rain. I just wanna be someone, just wanna feel something. To do with you, and you tear me away like the evening steals my love. I guess it was never really mine, 'cause I didn't have it till I saw you. I never really had. Forget you.